From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. A sudden flourishing of investigative journalism in China has created a sort of Wild West atmosphere. Crusading reporters and editors, armed with lurid accounts of corruption and official malfeasance, blazing away at the powers that be. But this Wild West is taking place in the authoritarian East, where Communist Party officials have made examples of newspapers and websites deemed too quick on the draw. Such repression points up the difficulty and sometimes absurdity of establishing a free press in a fascistic society. And that inherent conflict is also apparent in the teaching of journalism in China. Shi Guang Li is executive dean of the School of Journalism and Communication at Beijing's Tsinghua University. He joins us now. Professor Li, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Periodically in China, papers or websites are closed down. Journalists are fired or jailed for doing their jobs. How does one teach journalism in that kind of environment?
As a dean of journalism, I teach my student to present balanced, fair information to the public, not to lie, not to present biased opinions, not to present one-sided opinions.
Well, understood. Fairness obviously is a value you would want to embrace. But at least in the West, an important part of the function of journalism is to shine light in the darkest corridors of power, where sometimes people are up to no good. Are you teaching your students to be muckrakers, to investigate what the government or other institutions do not wish to have investigated?
There is a difference between the central government and the provincial and the local government. The central government, in the fight against the widespread corruption of the local government, encouraged journalists to write exposé of the corruption. But the local government are very much protective of themselves and of their power. So there is a conflict between the central government and the local government in dealing with journalists.
I guess it's not uncommon for local governments to be more like local mafias, no?
Not only the local government, but also the media itself is becoming a news mafia in China. I'm talking about a news mafia in China in the sense that the government control of the press is a visible hand. Everyone sees it. And sometimes you become a hero journalist overnight if the government criticizes you by name or if you're fired. But another control from the invisible hand, that's the market, the business side. And that also creates a lot of problems. So the Chinese press freedom is being suppressed by both the visible hand of the government and increasingly and more powerfully by the invisible hand of the market.
What you're describing is two extremes. On the one hand, government repression, and on the other hand, an irresponsible press. Which is the bigger problem?
An irresponsible press is the biggest problem. I can give you an example. Would you like a press like this? Last summer, all the Chinese press, newspaper and television are telling a lie that a vaccine for hepatitis is a poison. Eventually, scientists found it's not a poison. But the Minister of Health fear of telling the truth to the journalist that it's not a poison because he didn't want to see something different from the press because the press is identical with the public sentiment. So under such tyranny or tyranny of news mafia, the Chinese government official is very much afraid of telling truth. So is this good for the public interest?
On the other hand, there have been cases where the press has discovered pollution of rivers, where the press has discovered the SARS virus was spreading, and the government was the one doing the lying, denying that there had been outbreaks of SARS and denying that water supplies had been despoiled. And it was the press that broke through the official lies.
In China, there is a low threshold for entering the career of journalist because of the tendency of commercialization. The editor and the owner want to hire low-paid journalists. So they hire high school students instead of college graduate. And these high school students don't have a good knowledge of medical science or environmental science. So whenever an environmental or medical issue takes place, they only pay attention to the scandal involved, but not the scientific aspect. So as a result of the river pollution a couple of months ago, the mayor of that city under the pressure killed himself because of the media. So do we want to see people kill themselves under the pressure of press?
You said one thing that was interesting, that journalists who are targeted by the government and fired or jailed or something become heroes overnight. Well, for example, in the Freezing Point case, the editor was fired and Freezing Point was shut down. This is a weekly supplement to the China's Youth Daily. It will be allowed to reopen, but without that man as the editor. He has lost his job. What good does being a hero do him?
He did not lose his job. That's not true. The truth is that he's been shifted to the research department of the newspaper, and the government did not dare enough to fire him.
Well, what's he doing in the research department? Is he still running the newspaper and deciding what content will be printed and what stories will be pursued?
I don't know. You may ask the editor of China Youth Daily.
Very well. Dean Li, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for your question.
Xiguang Li is Executive Dean of the School of Journalism and Communication at Tsinghua University. The excesses of poorly trained sensationalists may be a problem, but David Bandersky, a researcher at the University of Hong Kong's China Media Project, says it's a problem that pales next to the essential conflict of Chinese journalism, communist leaders trying to navigate global free markets without surrendering to the free market of ideas. He joins me now. David, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
On the one hand, it seems as if the Chinese central government, the party, has given the press a much longer leash in the past few years, lots of muckraking in local papers and so forth. But then, periodically, the same authorities yank the leash to the choking point.
The point is that, yes, the media are on a leash, and sometimes the media can actually be used as kind of attack dogs. There's a term in Chinese, supervision by public opinion. In some cases, this can actually be newspaper reporters going and reporting corruption at a local level. So it can function as kind of an arm, in that case, of the state, where the higher level officials want to monitor what's going on in the provinces. Under this banner of so-called supervision by public opinion, you also get journalism that resembles very closely what we call watchdog journalism in the West. And a lot of reporters doing this envision themselves as independent reporters, and they really care about truth and about civic responsibility. So I think it's interesting to look at this watchdog journalism because you see under it both the best and the worst of Chinese journalism.
Well, in fact, we just spoke to the dean of Beijing's Tsinghua University about the very subject of watchdog journalism. But he also said that the press as a whole is losing credibility with Chinese citizens, he says, because it's so sensational and irresponsible and fixated on splashy headlines. Is he just an apologist, or is he right?
We are seeing commercialized media, but the real problem is that this commercialization has been encouraged by the party because they want to develop the media as an industry, and we now call it an industry, and that's a change even in the last 7 or 8 years. But it's still state-controlled. There are no independent media in China, and that, I think, is precisely the problem. We have this tension between the state function of the media, the mouthpiece. It also has a market function in China in that it's making money, competing for advertising. But it doesn't have yet a social function, and that's kind of where the battleground is. One of the examples that is probably something that Li Xiguang is talking about is this phenomenon called news extortion. And what this means is you sometimes get a newspaper reporter who will go and do an expose on, let's say, a meatpacking factory. And he'll write up his expose, he'll give it to his editor, and the editor will fax it to the head of this company and then give him a phone call and say, what are we going to do about this? And if the head of this meatpacking company cares about his business, generally he'll say, okay, we'll take out an ad contract.
Well, that extortion thing is an alarming anecdote. On any level, are things out of control?
If you do a search on news extortion, you will come up, on any given day, practically, you'll come up with material. Sometimes they're lone reporters or pretending to be reporters who go out and try to extort money from companies. There are examples like that. But I'll give you another example, and that's the Hunan AIDS crisis, when the world discovered that there was this AIDS epidemic in rural China. And a lot of foreign newspapers actually got credit for breaking the story, but it began when one young reporter was riding a train, Zhang Jicheng's his name, in the countryside in Hunan, and he met some farmers who were heading to Beijing to be diagnosed with this mystery disease that they had. And he published an expose about this. That piece was not published in Hunan because the local government was opposed to the story getting out, because the reason for this epidemic was the donation of blood and the retransfusion of blood. So this report was actually published in a province in western China by one of these new commercial newspapers. Obviously, this newspaper had a commercial interest in running a piece like this. This is a great story about an inept government, about a health issue that's really relevant to everyone in China. So there's commercial interest on the newspaper's part printing the story, but there's a real interest on the part of the individual reporter in just getting the story because he feels that this is his responsibility as a reporter.
So we always seem to come back to the paradox of contemporary China, an authoritarian regime trading in the free market, embracing some Western principles and trampling on others. But how do you sustain a partial tyranny? At some point, isn't this mutt bound to break free of the leash altogether?
That's the million-dollar question. There are a number of scenarios. The one I would hope for would be the development of a number of independent media in China, you know, under the Chinese constitution, which formally grants freedom of speech, but it's completely nominal. It obviously has no effect because China is still autocratic. But that's what I would hope for. What I fear is the determination of the party to maintain state control, even as they encourage commercialization. They want to open up the media and give it this tabloid look that it's attractive to the people, but it's just kind of an extreme makeover. You know, behind it, you still have a state-controlled media. So that's kind of the worst-case scenario.
All right. Well, David, thank you very much.
Certainly.
David Bandersky is a research associate at the China Media Project. He spoke to us from Hong Kong. Coming up, how the dolphin ate the whale and how that relates to a newspaper buyout. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Sunday night, the newspaper chain Knight Ridder, publisher of 32 papers across the country, was bought by the McClatchy Company, a publisher roughly half its size. The sale came after shareholders, disappointed with the performance of Knight Ridder's stock, forced the company onto the auction block. Because of the scale of the purchase, McClatchy announced its plans to keep only 20 of the freshly bought papers. The rest will be again put on the block, bringing no end of insecurity at papers in San Jose, California, Philadelphia, Akron, Ohio, Aberdeen, South Dakota, Monterey, California, Duluth, Minnesota, Grand Forks, North Dakota, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and St. Paul, Minnesota. Some fear that the purchase and double purchase of these properties will affect the quality of the reporting and is yet another indicator of the woeful state of the newspaper industry. Buzz Merritt was a Knight Ridder employee for more than 40 years. He ultimately retired as editor of the Wichita Eagle and is author of Nightfall, Knight Ridder, and How the Erosion of Newspaper Journalism is Putting Democracy at Risk. He joins us now. Buzz, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Was a time when Knight Ridder was, I think, widely considered the gold standard of newspaper chains. The last 4 or 5 years, particularly the last 2 years, I would say, has seen that reputation just completely obliterated. Tell me what's happened to Knight Ridder.
Well, the economic pressures from Wall Street were just beating the company up something terrible. Because Knight Ridder only had one tier of stock, stockholders, once the Knight and Ridder families were virtually out of it, the shareholders controlled the company and Wall Street control the goals that were set for the company.
Historically, though, it has been a publicly held company. How did Knight Ridder in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s manage to stay synonymous with quality journalism while at least nominally meeting the profit expectations of investors?
Well, I think a number of things happened. One is the leadership of the company changed over time. Another was that the whole attitude of Wall Street changed to the go-go 90s Wall Street that demanded increasing profits every quarter, if not every week. Knight Ridder and other companies with single tiers of stock have virtually no defense against that. The only option when the demand is for ever-increasing profits, one is to increase the revenue, and the newspaper environment was not right for that, so all that was left was to cut costs. And when you cut cost in a newspaper company, you're taking reporters off the street and editors out of the offices and doing things that contrive to drive readers away, and it only reinforces the problem. It was, I think, terrifically ironic that the things that Knight Ridder felt it had to do in the way of cutting cost were to save the company from precisely what has happened, from a takeover.
In fact, it's your view, is it not, that rather than the internet being the greatest peril to the newspaper business today, that it's Wall Street itself and its unrealistic expectations for 20, 25, 30% profit margins from newspaper chains?
Yeah, it's not just that it's 20%. Historically, newspaper operating returns have been very high. You had to be pretty stupid not to make a lot of money with a newspaper for about 60 years in this country. But it's the ever-increasing expectation. If you did 20 this year, then next year you better do 22, and the next year after that, 25, and there's a point at which the only way you can do that is to cut costs. Now, the issue for me is not so much can we save newspapers. The issue is can we save newspaper journalism and get it migrated onto the internet and these other platforms before it's totally eroded by the economic pressures.
Getting back to this transaction itself, what will be lost with the end of Knight Ridder as we've known it?
Oh, a lot of fine journalism history, for one thing. I think one thing that could be lost is the very good Knight Ridder Washington Bureau. I hope it won't be. The people will still be there. I assume that McClatchy has every intention of operating a strong, broad bureau as it has been operating. But I think it'd be a tragedy if there were a lesser commitment on the part of McClatchy to that Washington Bureau.
One of the possibilities to emerge from the resale of these properties by McClatchy is the Newspaper Guild being a bidder for the Inquirer and other papers. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that idea?
Well, it's an interesting idea, and apparently they have some people they think can put up the money. I'm not sure that has worked in other places where employees took over the newspaper, whether they were unionized or not. It did not work well in St. Louis a number of years ago. I know the people at those 12 papers aren't, but I'm excited about the possibility for those 12 newspapers that McClatchy is divesting because they may be bought by non-public companies, which would shield them from what is the primary problem right now for for newspaper companies, which is the profit pressure of Wall Street. I see that there's a group of people in Philadelphia who say they want to do a Green Bay Packers kind of thing with broad community involvement. And the way they're expressing it is this is a long-term investment, and it's also a civic venture, which ought to be encouraging words for the people at the Inquirer and the Daily News.
Back in the late 60s and early 70s, Ben Bagdikian was quite a prophet of doom about the future of newspapers because of what he deemed to be the trend, which has since been borne out, of the concentration of ownership to companies like Gannett and Knight Ridder, for that matter. Mm-hmm. Will Knight Ridder on its tombstone have the words Bagdikian was right?
As far as Knight Ridder was concerned, that die was cast in 1969 and 1974 when they went public with just one tier of stock. If you want to have somebody quoted on the tombstone, you would have to say Jack Knight was right, who said in 1969 that when you go public, you lose control of your destiny.
All right, Buzz. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Buzz Merritt is visiting professor of journalism at the University of North Carolina and author of Nightfall. St. Paul Pioneer Press General Assignment reporter David Hanners is one of those who has been in a state of ownership anxiety for months. He and his fellow reporters at the Pioneer Press have awaited news of their future, and they thought that Monday would bring some resolution. But instead, with McClatchy immediately announcing plans to resell his paper, he's right back where he started. He joins us now for a view from the ground. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you're sitting there on, you know, pins and needles for months, and
my reaction was one of kind of nervousness because McClatchy already owns a newspaper in this market, the Star Tribune over in Minneapolis, and my immediate thought was, what do they need two newspapers for in the Twin Cities? And I didn't think our future looked too bright.
And of course, they were having similar thoughts over at McClatchy. They immediately put the Pioneer Press on the market, and you found yourself in a very familiar situation. Tell me about your history in another city and another newspaper sale.
Yeah, I used to work in Dallas at the Dallas Morning News, the newspaper that prevailed in the newspaper war down there. And we saw kind of the same thing happen at the Times Herald, the other paper. When I went to work there in the early 80s at the Morning News, the Times Herald was owned by Times Mirror. They eventually sold out. And over the course of those differing owners, the Times Herald really lost a lot of good people, just had trouble covering the news and getting the newspaper on your doorstep and putting ads in the paper. And eventually it folded and they sold the assets to the Morning News.
I want to suggest one scenario that the situation there in St. Paul improves. Haven't you noticed a loss of resources for doing the kind of reporting you would like to do there in St. Paul? And isn't there the possibility that whoever the new owner is could actually feather your nest?
Yes, that's entirely possible. And there are a couple of, I think, prospective buyers in the wings that I think could do that. There's one of them in particular, a deal being put together by the Newspaper Guild that looks very attractive to us. And I would think a new owner would like to come in and show how nice he or she is and, you know, throw around a lot of money. And I'd be more than happy to help them spend it.
Okay, that's the best case scenario. Tell me what's the worst case from your point of view?
The worst case, I think, is a repeat of what I witnessed in Dallas with the Times Herald. You know, a new owner comes in. And they're not really committed to journalism. They see the profit number and they bleed us dry and there's really nothing left of us after a while and closes us and then sells the assets to McClatchy. The thing that I'm having trouble understanding is if McClatchy owns us, why do they want to keep a competitor in business? I think that's the question that a lot of us in the newsroom are having because we're kind of the people on the front lines of the newspaper war that we've been fighting. We wake up every morning thinking of some way to screw over the Star Tribune and get some story that they don't have. And their people wake up pretty much the same way.
You mentioned the interest of the Newspaper Guild as a potential purchaser of the Pioneer Press. Ever been to a guild meeting?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was an officer in our local.
Well, I don't want to be insulting or anything, but do you think this is a group that could publish a newspaper?
Your insinuation there is well taken. In a word, yes. One of the things that I think the Newspaper Guild deal has going for it is it divorces us from the need to make obscene profits. The Pioneer Press's profit is double digits, which most businesses around would be happy with. Wall Street, it seems, has wanted media companies to just make sky-high profits, and good journalism costs money. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't know if running a newspaper is rocket science or not. You know, I've just seen it from the newsroom side, and I know what I do isn't rocket science. That's why I went into it. But I think we are savvy enough to recognize good business people who could come in and, you know, make the smart moves that it takes to keep us profitable, but who also realize that constitutional franchise that we have, and that we have, you know, a duty and an obligation under that franchise to, you know, print the truth and raise hell.
Well, all the best in so doing. David, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
David Henners is a general assignment reporter for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Linda Foley is the president of the Newspaper Guild, a union of some 34,000 journalists. The Guild is preparing to bid on 12 newspapers that McClatchy has again put up for sale. 8 of those, incidentally, are already unionized and represented by the Guild. If their bid is successful, the purchase will create an unprecedented chain of employee-owned papers. Linda Foley joins us now. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
First of all, what are you trying to achieve here?
Well, we have two primary goals. One is to make sure that the employees have a stake and a say-so in what happens to them in this transaction. And along with that, that their rights are respected and that our collective bargaining agreements are honored. The second goal is that we believe that journalistic values need to be upheld and need to be a part of the business plans of these newspapers in order for them to have the long-term success that they've enjoyed so far. You know, let's be clear that these are not failing businesses. These are businesses that were part of a corporation whose primary shareholder said, they're not making enough money to suit me. None of them are losing money. So we really want to make sure that the management that runs these papers does value journalism and good journalism that's been the tradition at these papers heretofore.
Newspaper reporters are notoriously not well-heeled as a population, and I guess the Newspaper Guild is not the world's richest union. Where do you come up with the capital to acquire 12 newspapers?
Well, first, I want to correct a misconception about this. The union itself is not investing or not going to own any of these newspapers. We're playing a facilitating role and an advisory role in trying to put this together. The employees themselves will own a piece of this. But the real financing and real backing for this is coming from our partnership with Yucaipa Companies, which is a multi-billion dollar worker-friendly private equity firm in California. And when they heard what we were trying to do, they agreed that they would put the money up front, and then the employees are going to invest side by side with them in the new company.
Let's just say that it all works out exactly as you've planned, and you're able to help broker the acquisition of these 12 newspapers by the employees of those 12 newspapers. Suddenly, journalists are player managers. Do the values that inform journalism lend themselves to running a business?
Well, first of all, in terms of these employee companies, this is no different than if I am a shareholder of Knight Ridder stock. So when we say employee owned, they're not going to be running it day to day. There will be a management team that will not be the employees, will not be the reporters, but they will instead be a group of managers who are hired by the shareholders that include the employees. And by the way, they will have to negotiate collective bargaining agreements with the guild. We already sit across the bargaining table from a management hired by employee owners at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is one of the oldest employee-owned companies in the country, and also at the Bureau of National Affairs, which is a rather large publishing house that publishes technical publications about government policy and has approximately 2,000 employees. We sit across the bargaining table from the management selected by the employee shareholders. So it can be done. You anticipate that those relationships are going to be more productive and less adversarial. And in a lot of cases, they are, but sometimes they're not.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of details here. I'm not privy to the negotiations at individual properties. But I know throughout the industry, there has been a lot of chafing among journalists at the idea of having to file and refile and refile stories all day long to newspaper websites. You know, in the good old days or the bad old days, you used to file one story a day, maybe with one update for a late edition, and that was that. As employees own newspaper properties, aren't they in a peculiar position of fighting themselves in the transition from the old model to the brave new world?
Actually, I could argue about, you know, why that's frustrating. Some of it is the pace of the work, as you pointed out. And, hey, I'm not finished with that yet. And why do I have to put it up on the web? And I'm scooping myself. But the other part of that has to do with allocation of resources. You know, in some cases, the frustration is just because news staffs have been cut and pared down so much that you don't have the ability to do that. So, you know, I'm not sure what actually causes that angst, which is part of which. But we anticipate that there'll be a much more cooperative atmosphere in those newsrooms so that as those issues get worked out, because the employees are majority owners and because the management is working for those owners, that there is more of an incentive to work those things out in a more collaborative way.
All right, Linda. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling, and it's been a pleasure to be on your show.
Linda Foley is the president of the Newspaper Guild. And now an update. Last week, we interviewed Ellen Nickmeyer of the Washington Post in Baghdad, who reported a significantly higher death toll than did other news outlets in the wake of the bombing of the Shiite shrine in Samarra. Substantiated by a trip to the Baghdad morgue, Nickmeyer's story put the death count around 1,300, in contrast to the official count of 379. In response to our story, we received an email from an NPR reporter based in Baghdad. The reporter wrote that, though the official number was certainly low, there were nowhere near 1,300 dead, as Nickmeyer claimed. The email goes on to explain that many reporters did, in fact, visit the morgue, contrary to what Nickmeyer told us, and that their contacts have been consistently accurate and never withheld numbers. With no way to fact-check the dead, the numbers will continue to be lost in the fog for Nickmeyer and everyone else, further complicating the near-impossible task of reporting from Iraq. Coming up, on the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, we look back at war reporting through the ages. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week marks the 3-year anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq, which, of course, for the press means 3 years of covering the war in Iraq, a difficult but exciting job in the best of circumstances, and an extremely dangerous and thankless job in what has proven to be the worst of circumstances. Starting this week through the end of the month, Reuters is displaying on its Times Square ticker the names of the 67 journalists killed in Iraq. In this past week alone, three Iraqi journalists have been shot and killed, and Christian Science Monitor reporter Jill Carroll remains captive. The press has done a far from perfect job in Iraq, but there is no denying the nobility under the most extreme conditions of trying to find truth from those not necessarily willing to provide it. We listened back to the show we aired 3 years ago this week and decided to replay Brooke's interview about the history of war reporting with historian Philip Knightley.
In 1854, a London Times reporter named William Howard Russell became a star as the first famous war correspondent with this account of the British Light Cavalry Brigade against Russian gunners in Crimea.
At 11:10, our Light Cavalry Brigade advanced. They swept proudly past, glittering in the morning sun in all the pride and splendor of war. With a halo of steel above their heads, and with a cheer which was many a noble fellow's death cry, they flew into the smoke of the batteries. But ere they were lost from view, the plain was strewn with their bodies. Through the clouds of smoke we could see their sabers flashing as they rode between the gunners as they stood. At 11:35, not a single British soldier, except the dead and the dying, was left in front of the Muscovite guns.
Russell was seen as the first practitioner of a great tradition, war reporting. But when he looked back on it all, Russell called himself the miserable parent of a luckless tribe. The reason for that gloomy assessment can be glimpsed in a remark made by U.S. Senator Hiram Johnson in 1917. He said, "The first casualty when war comes is truth." Philip Knightley is author of the classic study of the foreign correspondent, The First Casualty. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why, when summing up his career, did Russell call himself the miserable parent of a luckless tribe?
I think he foresaw what was going to happen to that tribe. He foresaw that they would become, in their own way, propagandists for the government of the day. The military, who didn't like war correspondence right from the beginning, didn't want Russell along covering the charge of the Light Brigade because it brought home to a reading public, a greatly growing reading public, the horrors of warfare.
And it already began to change during Russell's career.
Yes, by the time that Russell was finished with the Crimea and moved off to the American Civil War, the power of the press with its war reporting had brought down a government in Britain and infuriated all the generals who up until then had reported their own wars.
Brought down the government in Britain?
Yes, the reports about the inefficiency of the supply requirements of the army, about the way that soldiers were left lying untreated, wounded on the battlefield, that led to Florence Nightingale going over to the Crimea in order to help these soldiers, brought down the government of the day.
Well, let's skip past the charge of the Light Brigade to the American Civil War. Now, the coverage there should have been extraordinary. Suddenly, reporters had access to this astounding new communications technology, the telegraph. But you write that it was covered miserably.
Yes, because already we can sense a certain corruption creeping in the way reporters reported. They began to realize their power. They began to charge various officers sums of money to give them a puff in the press, as they said.
But was that all? Was it simply that the reporters were after personal gain, or was there the politics of nations getting in the way?
Well, a lot was beginning to creep in. Politicians began to realize that nations fight as its people think, and that you can manipulate the way people think in wartime by clever manipulation of the war correspondents themselves.
Now, the twin forces of propaganda and censorship acquired a very modern efficiency during the First World War. Could you set the scene?
The scene was that the military by now, alarmed in the latter part of the 19th century at the power that war correspondents were displaying, revolted against having war correspondents around at all. And they announced that with the British Expeditionary Force to France to fight Germany, they would allow only five war correspondents, and they sort of incorporated them into the army. They said you can come if you can ride a horse, and that you will be given all the status of, say, a captain, and that you will have a batman and a driver and a personal censor, and we will show you what we think you should see. So you got none of the horrors of the First World War. You got none of the slaughter of the trenches. They said it's been a glorious day for Britain today, when in fact something like 100,000 people, 100,000 soldiers have been killed in one battle alone.
Now, that was a war when reporters signed on to the cause. They were committed to the Allied victory. But during the Spanish Civil War, there was a division between governments and among the press over who was right. There was no objectivity. There wasn't any middle ground. And most of the reporters sided with the Republicans.
They saw the fight there, the Republican government against the insurgents led by fascist General Franco, as being the beginnings of what later on became the Second World War.
Rumbling eastward this week from Aragon toward the sea in the mightiest offensive since the World War is the mechanized army of Spanish rebel General Francisco Franco. Tanks from the great German firm of Krupp, bombers from Italy's Caproni, Italian armored trucks, German heavy artillery, a crushing juggernaut that blasts its way through every loyalist defense on toward the loyalist industrial center and seaport of Barcelona.
They saw the great battle developing between democracy and fascism and felt that the Spanish Republican Army deserved to win.
And with the stakes so high, the first casualty is truth principle kicked in with a vengeance. And the reporters actively slanted their stories. They even made things up, both the pro-Republicans and the pro-fascists.
Yes. I mean, I can give you a good example of making things up. The denial of the bombing of Guernica. This was a bombing carried out by German planes working, fighting with the Franco-fascists.
Immortalized in the Picasso painting.
Indeed. There was a concerted move by the propagandists for the Franco side to make certain that the public got the view that this was an entirely invented story by pro-Republican reporters, and that what really happened there was simply that the people of Guernica had destroyed the town themselves in order to blame the German bombers for what had occurred.
On the pro-Republican side, you spend a fair amount of time on the journalist Claude Coburn, who is a fine writer, but you saw his Spanish War coverage as a disaster.
He admits himself that on one occasion he sat down with a Comintern officer and a map of a town so as to make certain that they got the details right, and they totally invented a battle, which was won by the gallant Republican army against the hordes of fascists who had been storming them. He became so attached to what he felt was the right side that he lied in order to put that side in the best possible light.
You quote him telling his wife, with regard to the public's right to the truth, he said, "Who gave such a right? Perhaps when they have exerted themselves enough to alter the policy of their bloody government and the fascists are beaten in Spain, they will have such a right. This isn't an abstract question. It's a shocking war."
Yes, that sums up very well the way that he felt about it. Later on, other correspondents have said that they feel that the public right to know and the public right to objective or fair reporting can come back when the war is over. But in the meantime, it's necessary to win the war.
What about the coverage of World War II, the good war? From the standpoint of journalism, was it as good as all that?
No. I mean, I quote at the end of that chapter a Canadian war correspondent who'd been working for one of the big news agencies is saying, looking back after the war was over, he was appalled at what he'd written. He said, we weren't reporters, we weren't even historians, we were just propagandists for the Western side. But you see, in a war of national survival, it's very easy to get the journalist on side. You don't want to be accused of doing anything that might inhibit your government from winning what you and they consider to be a just war.
Departing almost to a split second on the right time, on a plan which they've been working and sweating and slaving at for months. The sky now is full of the noise of these paratroop planes as they circle the aerodrome before they take their course. But just as they're circling in the air, so the others that are waiting to go are circling the track of the aerodrome, their lights moving round in a stately, steady procession. Aboard them are some of the toughest and finest and bravest men that we have in Britain, and they go out today to face their greatest trial.
At least the Germans avoided the hypocrisy of the Allied side, where the Allies pretended that these war correspondents were writing the truth and writing impartial reports and fair reports. The Germans simply herded all the war correspondents into a semi-army unit called a propaganda company and told them what to write.
Let's jump ahead to Vietnam. Now, that was the first time when reporters were actually accused of helping to hand victory to the enemy. Did they?
The American military certainly believes that's the case. I don't know what aberration occurred in the military mind in the Pentagon during the Vietnam War, but some aberration did occur because they decided they would trust the war correspondents to be on side. I mean, they'd been on side to a large extent in Korea, and they thought they would enjoy the same support from the press as they'd enjoyed there. So they just handed them on a platter a card that said, you can go anywhere you want, we will help you get there, we'll provide you with rations when you are there, and you can write anything you like. But we'll rely on you and your good sense and your patriotic duty to write the story as you see it. Well, it worked for a while because most American war correspondents there did feel that the war was a just one, but they began to object to the way in which the war was being waged.
The long, wearying, and oftentimes baffling war against communist rebels in South Vietnam swung sharply toward a new crisis today. For the first time in the years-long struggle, the scene of action has shifted from the jungles and rice paddies to the sea and involved naval craft instead of guerrilla fighters. Hard on the heels of an attack Sunday and in the face of a warning from Washington, North Vietnamese torpedo boats opened an attack on two United States destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin today.
The public back in the United States learned the full truth about body counts, and they learned the truth about assassination squads, and they learned the truth about the deaths of innocent people. They learned the truth about various American atrocities. And this so sickened the viewer and the reader that they lost the will to continue the war.
War reporting changed after Vietnam, didn't it?
Yes, it changed amazingly for the worse. What happened was that military chiefs all over the world looked at Vietnam and thought, what lessons can we learn from this? And at a conference held in the Royal United Services Institute in London, in 1975, I think it was, attended by representatives of the Pentagon, the Ministry of Defense here, and a number of senior journalists, the question of, can we ever again allow color television cameras or any television cameras on the battlefield again and to cover a war no matter how just that war might be? And the conclusion was a resounding no. So from that moment on, the Pentagon and the Ministry of Defense worked on a plan to manage the media in wartime. And it turned out to be a very simple but very effective plan. The military now controls access to the war, and nobody is allowed there unless the military takes you or allows you to go.
Grenada, Panama,
yeah.
and the Gulf.
And the Gulf.
We've been receiving some late reports from Baghdad that it appears airports and military installations near the Iraqi capital have been hit. What do you say about that?
This strikes me as an orderly way of shutting a country down. We are making war at all of Saddam's most important war-making capacities. The one thing I am not hearing is that we are not apparently making war on the innocent civilians.
The military made it very difficult for war reporters to get to the front to see what was happening. They were taken on little conducted tours that were with the pool system, which all journalists hate. Pool system being a group of reporters that are selected or self-selected, and they are required to report for the whole of the media. And they're conducted where the military thinks it's safe to let them go, and they're censored. The major American media organizations objected to this and considered bringing an action while the war was on, claiming that this infringed their right of freedom of expression. But then their own rivalry with among themselves led to the abandonment of that, and only the nation continued it, and by the time that they would have got a decision, the war was over. But the judge did rule that there was a case to answer.
Well, what about the coverage of Kosovo? There was plenty of reporting there that didn't suit government policy. There were some on-the-scene accounts. Was that finally good, unimpeded reporting?
Well, we're getting into a real minefield here about what is good unimpeded reporting. Before the reporters got there, the government justification for what was happening had so demonized the Serbs that it became very difficult for any reporter not to join the mainstream stories of Serb atrocities. a lot of the war correspondents, mostly young and inexperienced. The quick story to do was, I witnessed an atrocity today, or I've discovered another mass grave. And they were known among the various independent interpreters there as the mass graves correspondents.
And so reporting was abundant, but it wasn't any good.
Yes, it's quite possible in wartime to say, well, we've been showered, inundated with material, but very little real information. You had to look around for an old Balkans hand who understood the centuries of animosity that led to what had occurred, and follow him or her in order to get a real idea of what was occurring.
Your book is studded with stories of lucky and courageous correspondents who found themselves in the right place at the right time and managed to get the story through. And a lot of what stood in their way was simply the technology of the era. We have myriad ways to get words from one continent to another and out in front of the public. Shouldn't it be easier now to evade the kinds of obstructions that governments put in front of war reporting?
Satellite phones and navigational positioning devices and all that sort of thing make it much, much easier to get the story back. But what is the story? It is not difficult to manage the media in wartime. You deny them access. You provide them with almost unlimited information, but information that you want to get published. And you denigrate and slander any correspondent who attempts to report the war from the other side.
Well, Philip, I must say this has all been very reassuring.
Well, I know it's not very reassuring, but maybe we'll win through. But I'm afraid I'm a pessimist about the future of being war correspondents unless there is some major change in the way that the governments and the military view them.
Well, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
Philip Knightley is the author of First Casualty, The War Correspondent as Hero and Mythmaker from the Crimea to Kosovo, now in a new updated edition.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ani Katz and Mark Phillips. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org, and thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.